So I ordered pizza tonight, Alan.
Really? From where I think you might have, or no?
Well, yeah, probably.
Where the place that you promised to order from last discussion?
No, unfortunately. Oh, if you know me, if you know me well enough, you know that I'm a creature of habit, and that I ordered from Panini's when I could have decided to order from the Hydo or from Seps
or Campus.
Or Campus, right? Or Rosa. And actually, I looked to try an order from Campus. I did last week look to try an order from Campus, and it wasn't, I don't know. I don't think it's on Skip. Maybe, I thought I looked on both Skip and Uber and didn't see it, but it's also possible. Oh, I know what, I did find it on one of them, and it was closed when I looked, so.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I haven't had pizza from Campus yet. Did you have it between the last time we talked and now?
Yep.
You did? Oh, yep. Dang.
They're open late, man.
Yeah. I should have got you to save me a piece.
How was Panini's?
It was good.
Yeah.
It was good. Yeah. Although, like, it's funny because, like, their thin crust pizza, unlike Seps, if you order a large and you have more than, like, and you add any toppings to it, which I ordered a pepperoni and I got pineapple on it.
Right. Yep.
It's a little, it tends to be a little soggy in the middle, which I don't really mind too much, but sometimes it's worse than others. And the one that I got tonight was, had lots of toppings, but was pretty soft.
Yeah.
So.
And even folding it, was it problematic?
Folding it kind of works, but still you kind of have to eat the very tip before you try to fold it and pick it up. But yeah, folding it does work.
Wait a minute, you have to eat the tip before you pick it up.
You have to eat the tip before you fold it and pick it up. Yeah. So how do you do that?
Fork, or you put your face in the box?
Basically, I didn't actually use a knife and fork. I sort of like pulled it off.
Okay.
And ate it like its own little tiny separate piece of pizza or something. I don't even know how to describe it.
Your hors d'oeuvre, perhaps, or
yes, it was my pizza amuse bouche. I took some of the little toppings from the rest of the piece and put them on there so that it was really good. And I dipped it in ranch.
Oh.
Welcome to the Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my friend Alan Sutterby. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm quite good, thank you.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Alan, feels like a month since we've spoken.
A lot's happened.
Just kidding, that's your line.
Oh. A lot's happened. Summer is over. Forget about it. It's gone.
Summer's in the dust.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're back at work now, hey?
Mm-hmm. School's in session.
School's back in session.
Forever.
Alice Cooper's mad about it.
Culinary school is up and running. The restaurant will be open in the next few days.
Whoa.
Kids are going back.
Wait, there are students already?
Yeah, we started before the long weekend. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Nobody else's school started yet.
No, not till after, yeah. Anyways, yeah, summer's just a distant memory now. And
all your summer reads, we're going to have to wait until next year to talk about.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
All your beach reads. That's okay.
But
I'm sure you'll have a whole new set of beach reads next summer.
I've already started a list and an Amazon list, actually. And an Edmonton Public Library list, but a lot of stuff from Amazon, too.
Alan, do you publicly share your Amazon list? Because maybe some of our listeners will go on there and just gift you the books.
Oh, is that a thing on Amazon? Like a feature of Amazon?
Well, it's a thing on Amazon, and it's a thing that influencers do. They like make an Amazon list of stuff that they want, and then people go and buy it for them.
Oh, really? And what do the people who buy it get out of it? They get to see their influencer comment on it?
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, yeah. To see their name mentioned on the stream or whatever it is.
Huh.
And they get the good feeling of having some done something nice for someone who is unemployable.
Yeah.
Just kidding. This is a bad joke.
I probably won't go that route, but I mean, I'll share it just for interest sake, and maybe people can read the same books and be part of the discussion. But
sweet, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Wait, Alan, do you use Goodreads?
No. Are you about to give a word from our sponsor? Or
I wish. No, but I do use Goodreads, but I. And yeah, I mean, like, I think like it's a pretty good log of, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say most, but a lot of the books that I've read. Every couple of, what usually happens is I forget to update it for a while. And then every couple of years I like go in and I'm like, oh yeah, I read this and I read that and I read this. And then I update it. And then so people probably get like spam in their inbox, but you can follow people on Goodreads and see what they're reading. And
Is that its principal function? Like to
like it's kind of like
get reading recommendations book. And stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of like a social network book club.
Oh, okay, I could see that being fun. On the other side, I feel like there's no shortage of recommendations and things that I want to read, and the real issue is the time to read it. But
oh yeah, totally. I wouldn't say that you would need to use it to find new things to read necessarily. It's just sort of like, what's the one for movies where you just like log the things that you've read, or in the case of the movie one, watched, what's that called? Letterboxd.
Oh, I don't know about the movies. There's one for beer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you log the beers that you drank. Which, and you get.
Alan has very long lists on.
I don't have a profile or whatever, but yeah, like you get. It's almost like Reddit, where like the more comments you make and the more upvotes they get, the more your clout is on the platform. It's the same with beers.
Right. So Goodreads is much less like socially than a lot of things. Like,
right.
Like I do get updates when people say, like have read a new book or something. Like I get something in my email inbox, but it's not like constantly trying to get you to like, I don't know, read stuff that your friends are reading, or right. trying to get you to share your contacts list or anything like that. It's very passive.
Right.
It's mostly just for logging the things that you've read and being able to go back and be like, oh yeah, I remember when I read that. And you can also rate the books that you've read.
Right.
Anyways, moving on.
Moving on.
Do we have any follow up?
No.
Okay. Cool. No feedback. Oh wait, is your article published yet, Alan? I do have some follow up.
No, it's going to print 1 week from today, almost actually.
Yeah. Dang.
Yeah. So it'll be distributed.
Fire up the presses.
Extra, yeah. Extra, Alan posts article. No, extra, extra, local man eats pizza.
Extra, extra, local man walks to pizza joint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right on. Well, maybe after it's published, if you get any feedback in the, about your article in the community newsletter inbox, you'll have to let us know.
I will. And I will.
I want to read the final published version too. Hey, wait, where can I pick up a copy?
So you have to live, if you want a print copy, we only distribute to people within the community boundaries of McKernan.
Right.
However,
what about campus pizza?
I was going to say, at Campus Pizza, they have newspapers and magazines out for you to read while you're waiting for your pizza, and they'll always Sweet. Have the last few editions or the last few issues of The Messenger too.
Man, Alan, I feel like we're having the craziest circular conversation of all time.
Why?
I don't know. It's just like it's going in this weird. I don't know. I feel like I'm falling down a Nautilus shell or something, because we're talking about pizza and then we're talking about campus pizza and then And then we were talking about books, and then we were talking about your article, and then we somehow got back to Campus Pizza.
Yeah. Speaking of Campus Pizza,
like
use promo pizza. Code Food Court. okay, but seriously,
sponsor us.
Let's move on. Summer's over.
I'm ready.
Now it's fall. One cool thing about fall, and we talked about it this time last year, is Kevin Costwin's From the Wild cookery camps that he does on his property north of Edmonton near Rochester, Alberta. And guess what, Shale?
You did it again.
I did it again. Over the last couple weeks, did two more classes with him.
That's cool.
And
like, you don't have enough to do starting up school and writing your new fall menu. And
it was bad timing, but it was
man,
fun.
When it rains, it pours, right?
Yeah. I haven't done jack for 2 months, and then all of a sudden I don't see my family for a week basically. But but yeah, it was fun. And there was a couple of dishes that we did that were exactly the same as last year, but there was a lot new and some really interesting ideas in wild food and some really cool flavors, cool and surprising flavors. And so I wanted to tell you a bit about it.
Yeah, I want to hear about it.
Okay. Let's do it then. Sure. Agreed.
Agreed. Okay. Let's get into it. Before we get into it, that just sort of like jogged my memory about this like thing that I've been seeing show up on my TikTok. And I don't think I followed them at any point, but somehow the algorithm knows that I'm interested in wild food in Alberta. And I keep seeing stuff on my For You page from the Alberta Mycological Society.
Oh, yeah.
There's like a woman who does events for them. I recognize her, but I don't think I know her name.
Okay.
But they did like this, well, they do like a, I forget what it's called. It's called like a mushroom walk or something, but they do an event at the, what used to be the Devonian Botanical Gardens. Now I think it's the University Botanical Garden.
Yep.
They do like a mushroom event out there, like near the end of the summer every year.
That's right.
And she was saying that like this year was particularly crazy for foraged mushrooms just because of like, mostly the way that it was like hot and then rained all at once, and it rained like started raining like I don't know a week and a half before they were going to do their event. And so she found some like really crazy rare mushrooms that you don't really find very much that she was able to present at the event and stuff, and I found that to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it has been a crazy, sorry, the AMS, Alberta Mycological Society, is awesome, and I had some like really formative experiences going on walks and forays with them early in my cooking career that really blew my mind, actually.
That's cool.
And yeah, that event, I don't know if they still call it this, but it used to be that August event at the Botanical Gardens. It used to be called City of Champignon, one of the great Edmonton food jokes of all time. and I've actually cooked at that event a few times.
Cool. But I assume you didn't go this year.
I didn't this year. No, I was I was invited, but I was on a I was on a float down the North Saskatchewan River that day.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, apparently you missed a barn burner, Alan.
So yeah, it has been a crazy year for mushrooms, and we were able to use quite a bit at these From the Wild classes. And
we'll perfect. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
I was hoping that would tie in somehow.
good tie in. The first class was another edition of the Food as Medicine course, where Alberta botanist Robert Rogers comes and leads some walks and introduces wild ingredients and tells you about the effects they have on your body and your health.
Right.
And in this one, we had a couple dishes that we did last year that we just brought back because they worked so well and were received so well. The first one was the kind of canapé, which was cured fish on a rice cracker. It's this rice cracker that we've talked about a handful of times that uses the what we've been calling like the chicharrón method of overcooking, rolling out, drying, frying. and the cured fish. So nothing new to report here, except that I've really fine-tuned that rice cracker preparation. And actually a quick cure for salmon or char, like a 48-hour cure that ends up with a really great texture that I haven't been able to achieve this quickly before.
Oh, that's awesome.
But like a rub down with 2.25% salt by weight and then vacuum packing it for 24 hours.
Okay.
Taking it out, rinsing it, patting it dry, crusting it with spice if you want, and then just leaving it on a rack uncovered in the fridge for 24 hours. And it has really beautiful, like dense, smooth texture.
Cool.
So yeah.
Yeah, we used to do a cure that was very similar to that at Fiskabar when I was there. It was like, I think it was even less. I think it was like a 24-hour thing. Mm-hmm. But we were curing trout like that for our tartare, and it was like a very light cure, but yeah, just like a really rich feeling texture. And
was it vacuum sealed?
But still like didn't feel like overly cured or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it vacuum sealed or?
I don't think so, actually.
Okay. But yeah, it's something.
I'm sure that helps.
More like sometimes it's called like an equilibrium cure where you're basically adding just as much salt as you want to end up in the finished product, as opposed to like usually when you're brining meat or something, it's like there's way more
salt. Brining it in more than you would.
And then time becomes very crucial. Like it can only stay in the brine for whatever it is, a day every 2 pounds of meat or something. But
without getting over cured.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, we don't have to retread that anymore. But the next course, what I really like about doing these sessions with Kevin is that he's almost like an executive chef who gets a kernel of an idea, like when he's out in the wild, tastes something, gets an idea for how it could possibly be used in a dish, and then sometimes sees that through all by himself. But in the case of these classes that I've done with him, just kind of like presents an idea to me and says like, I want this ingredient used in this way in this dish. And then the rest, like you figure it out and you can, you make it happen.
That's cool.
And so the kernel of the idea, so getting into mushrooms now, there's a few different kinds of mushroom that are in the genus called Hericium. Some that grow here wild, some that are farmed here, and some that are wild, maybe next door in British Columbia. The common names that are most familiar, like lion's mane is one, lion's mane mushroom.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think that grows wild here. It does in BC. One that grows wild here is called coral tooth mushroom. This is Hericium coralloides. And it's a very distinctive mushroom. The name kind of says it all. It looks like imagine a big white piece of coral. So like these kind of like fingers moving out and up. But then now imagine like a shaggy lichen or like really slender teeth, like dripping off of every surface of this piece of coral. So that's why it's called coral tooth. So it's kind of like shaggy. Yeah, shaggy coral.
I wonder if I've seen it before. I'm really curious to look up a picture of it right now.
Yes. It's very distinctive looking. It grows, I don't know what kind of wood, but it's almost always found on decaying, like fallen timber.
Logs and stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, so the kernel of the idea was that these mushrooms, if you can picture lion's mane, they shred apart like along a very particular parallel grain.
Right.
And the idea was that when you shred them like that, they kind of start to look like crab meat, like lump crab meat.
Right.
And so Kevin had the idea of like, can we make a crab cake, something that presents and has the texture of a crab cake, but does not contain crab, or maybe it does contain crab. That's whatever. Cool. But he wanted to work with the shredded varieties of Hericium mushroom. And he said, so maybe a crab, like a in quote, like a in playful quotation marks, crab cake with slaw or whatever it is. And we ended up, I cooked some of the mushroom, shredded it apart. And it's crazy, actually. Like once these mushrooms are cooked and shredded, visually, they are dead ringers for, depending on how you cook them, pulled pork or lump crab meat or
right.
whatever. The lion's mane in particular really does have like a meaty succulence to it after it's shredded like mm-hmm. that. It doesn't taste like pork, obviously, and it doesn't have like the gelatin and stuff like that. But it's delicious and meaty. That coral tooth one looked just like crab meat to me. It's a little bit drier and not as succulent, a little bit more chewy, but still mm-hmm. Tasty and a fun texture. So we ended up treating them a bit like some kind of deep fried Vietnamese cake that you would eat like wrapped in lettuce with pickled veg or chili peppers and dipped in nyok sham and or fish sauce and stuff like that.
Right.
And yeah, it was the texture was really crazy. Like I don't think it tasted meaty. I mean, dipped in fish sauce, it certainly did, but like right. I would say the textures were pretty well dead ringers for some form or some types of meat. So it was the shredded cooked mushrooms, treated like a crab cake. So like with a bit of egg and a bit of breadcrumb
and I was gonna ask you how you bound it.
Yeah. And I think with that coral tooth one, that was, like I said, was a bit drier. I also added a bit of cornstarch to really just make sure it stuck. But yeah, it was a really fun course.
Cool. So like eating a crab cake in a lettuce wrap.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And I think we actually had, kale greens and mustard greens from, Kevin's yard. But yeah, when I was...
Did you use fish sauce that Kevin made from fish that he caught?
No, and it's not like... there is always an important wild featured ingredient in these courses, but they're by no means entirely wild. And
yeah,
for a number of reasons, like for the animal protein, like we're not allowed to serve true wild protein.
Fair enough, yeah.
And yeah, like we use lots of... agricultural products and like ethnic and international product like flavors and stuff like that. So
totally. Still though, I think we should make fish sauce.
Yeah, absolutely. Or like beef garum or something.
Garum. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's do it. I don't know. Cool. I don't have time actually.
Yeah, me neither really. Not right now anyways. I've been thinking a lot about making koji though, but I really need a dehydrator to do it properly.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't have a dehydrator right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have the will to go shopping for one. Oh. I don't know.
Put it on your Christmas list.
I mean, I want one. If a dehydrator showed up, oh yeah, maybe I should put it on my Amazon wish list.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, if I had a dehydrator, I'd probably have a batch of koji going in my downstairs right now, but yeah. Anyway, okay. So what was the medicinal sort of story that went along with the mushroom cake situation?
The short answer is I don't really know because I was cooking the food and not part of the discussion and presentation. Oh, yeah.
I think I did this to you last year.
Yeah, exactly. but I do know, like, even in some more like popular science kind of outlets, like there was a documentary called Fantastic Fungi. Just a really corny name, but it was a pretty good movie that was released a few years ago. And also... Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, he also recently did a book about, I think broadly it was about drugs and intoxication, but that there was a pretty heavy mushroom component. So like this idea of like microdosing psilocybin and stuff like that.
Right.
But very, very broadly, mushrooms are being found to have really significant effects on our, especially like our mental health and cognition and memory and things like that. But I honestly don't know what specifically Robert talked about with the hericium mushrooms. So sorry.
Understood.
The next course was one that was also a straight rip from last year, and it was mushroom gnocchi. And these are potato gnocchi, where a portion of the flour content in the original recipe was replaced with dried mushroom powder. And this was shaggy parasols, which also were, actually even right now, like at this day that we are recording, they are coming up prolifically all around Edmonton.
Really?
Yeah. And so made gnocchi with powder, which would have been from last year's mushrooms, but then also served them in a cream sauce with this year's fresh mushrooms too. And topped with parm and crispy speck. And yeah, it was a hit last year, so we played it again.
Did it again.
Yeah.
Were there any returning guests?
There was, and they were not upset to eat it again. Or they were not disappointed.
That's fair. Do you know, do any of those mushrooms grow in Mill Creek?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I've been walking in Mill Creek a lot, but I'm usually on the path and I'm not really like, you know, in the shaded, like in the treed areas as much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe next time I'm walking down there, I'll just like veer off the path a little bit and keep my eyes peeled.
I know that one of the places that Robert Rogers most commonly does River Valley walks to, like, for plants and mushrooms, with groups to introduce them to some of the plants and mushrooms that grow in the city. Mill Creek is one of the most common places he goes.
Cool.
I don't know if that, not necessarily because it's the most prolific or interesting, but like it's accessible and it's in the city and there's enough there to talk about for some time. So
yeah, totally. And it's maybe not as crowded as a lot of the like actual River Valley locations, right, or parks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
The dessert for this year was something new. The featured ingredient for Robert to talk about was to be wild mint. And Kevin wanted to do some kind of play on mint chocolate chip ice cream, which is what
one, ice cream one,
did you, is mint chocolate chip in the top 5 greatest flavors of all time, or the top 10, or what's your take?
Oh, man, that's tough.
Probably 10, right?
Yeah, it's probably in the top 10 classic flavors. I don't know for sure if I'd put it in my own personal top 10.
Oh, really?
Maybe.
Hot take.
Yeah, it might squeak in, but yeah, I think mint chip is in the top 10 classic flavors probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I did was, this was actually, there's so many things that like whatever themes or motifs in these recordings show that just come up again and again. Campus Pizza is one, and obviously 11 Madison Park is one. So in the first 11 Madison Park cookbook, there's a chocolate and mint dessert that I was inspired by and maybe took a couple recipes from.
Cool.
We did a mint ice cream. We had some chocolate mint and some, oh, I don't know what the other one was. Was it peppermint? I don't know. Primarily chocolate mint though. And I made they call it a mint sorbet, even though it's made with half and half cream.
Okay.
In the EMP.
I call it a sherbet, but yeah.
Yeah. Does a sherbet need fruit though, or no? And there was no eggs, so it was more like a Philadelphia ice cream or something. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I think a sherbet can have no eggs. I think it just needs, it's like a sorbet with a dairy component. Oh, generally,
okay. Yeah,
is like the, yeah.
Okay, so tell me, maybe this is common, but I hadn't come across it before because I'm not a pastry chef and have only made ice cream a handful of times in my life. You infuse the cream with the mint by like bringing it near the boil and then dumping a really generous amount of mint in it and leaving it for 30 or 60 minutes. And then it tastes very powerfully of mint, but it's still white. To get that classic green tint, you blanch some more mint and then blanch it and shock it in ice, squeeze out the excess moisture, and then puree it right into the cream.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Like I said, no eggs. So to me, it was a Philadelphia style ice cream. Didn't have the greatest texture, like it's a little bit icy to me.
Okay. How did you churn it?
In my really fancy Carpigiani,
like
batch freezer, commercial batch freezer.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
You just had such a sarcastic eyebrow raise. Like, is that not?
No, it's fancy. Not everybody has access to stuff like that.
No, I'm spoiled and fortunate and blessed. Is that enough?
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough. Thanks for apologizing.
Anyways, great, really great mint flavor. And then I put that ice cream onto a bed of chocolate chip cookie crumble, and then had a nice little wedge of chocolate, like a chocolate delice. Like, it's basically just fancy ganache. It's actually like the chocolate torta from Corso 32.
From Corso.
I like that kind of vibe.
So it has eggs in it?
It has egg yolk in it, yeah.
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 Yeah, and then garnished with pretty... Oh, sorry. And the chocolate delice was garnished with Maldon salt and mint flowers, like little purple mint flowers. So you had a nice little pastel green mint ice cream and pastel violet mint flower color. I thought it was cute.
That sounds beautiful. Are you going to put a picture of it on our Instagram? Do you have a picture of it?
I don't personally, but Kevin certainly does.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, there are pictures of all of these courses do exist. And some of them are already up on the From the Wild feed, but we can see.
Oh yeah, maybe we can tag. Can you do that? Reverse tag yourself. I don't think so.
Reverse tag.
I'm in this photo.
Reverse tag. I'm it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first course, Food as Medicine. And then the one that just happened yesterday, the day before we're talking now.
Right. Man, you must be exhausted.
I don't feel great, but no, I'm fine. It's called Field Cookery. So people who are interested in cooking in the field.
Cooking outdoors.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And this one was all new. I did do this class with them last year, but this was all new dishes.
Oh, cool.
And the hors d'oeuvre was to be a play on a jalapeno popper. And I'm a tourist in the hunting and wild food space. Like, I don't really do it myself, but like I tag along with people who do and get to cook with them and stuff. So apparently in the United States, dove hunting is a thing.
Okay.
It's like a hardcore marksman kind of thing, because they have, they're small birds with very frenetic flight patterns.
Right.
So
they're so hard to shoot.
Yeah. Don't get me started.
Sorry.
Yeah. Like, it's definitely a sport, but apparently, this is not just for doves, but for game birds generally, but for dove hunting especially, there's some kind of tradition in the United States of making dove poppers or like duck poppers, like jalapeno poppers that contain slices of the bird that you hunted that day, like a post-hunting barbecue situation. What's your...
Did you bring some jalapenos with you in case you gun down a dove?
I think this is like, you're done hunting for the day, you go home, crack a beer, start the barbecue, and you make poppers.
Make some jalapeno poppers.
I think so. I don't know. So
aren't jalapeno poppers supposed to be deep fried?
Yeah, like breaded and deep fried, or wrapped in, or sometimes wrapped in bacon, maybe.
Okay.
The reference that Kevin gave me, like as a like to someone to explain the tradition and offer a take on it, is another wild food dude named Hank Shaw, who has a website called Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. He's published books, and his blog is like actually a pretty amazing resource for cooking wild food. He has a post on this tradition and his own version of the dish. Anyway, so that was the starting point. We were working with duck for this, and so the final take was this. Break down the duck, the legs get confit. Oh, sorry. Let me take a step back.
Okay.
The skin is removed from the duck.
Okay.
In one sheet. And it is cured and smoked like bacon.
Oh.
So it's duck skin bacon. And then
does it get crispy? Well, like,
no, it's I guess
then you smoke it and then what, you cook it after?
So I just cured it overnight, rinsed it, patted it dry, cold smoked it, and then sandwiched it between bake sheets and put it in a 350-degree oven. And some of the, it was interesting. I didn't really, like, when I take the skin off a chicken, there's some parts where the subcutaneous fat is a bit thicker, a bit thinner, but it's pretty uniformly thin.
Yeah. But, and generally when you're making chicken skin like that, if you want to like crisp it up or something, part of the process of cleaning it is removing some of the excess fat.
Right. Yeah.
Which I would think would be a much more difficult situation in the case of duck skin.
Right. So when I took the skin off the duck, there was obviously it's thicker and has more fat, and there was much more variation in the fat content. And there was even like some bits of meat that came off with it too. So all of that was kept though, cured, cold smoked, sandwiched between bake sheets and rendered out. And so some of the thinner parts got crispy, like crackling, but most of it was just like a kind of almost like a jerky, like, sweet, salty, smoky, chewy, sorry, not as tough as most jerky, but, anyways, that's the skin.
Dang.
The legs were confit and shredded and mixed with hot mustard and sriracha. And the breasts were just taken off and cooked medium. So our popper itself is actually, it's not a jalapeno popper. I had those little baby, like sweet baby bell peppers.
Oh.
And torched them and took the skin off and then cut a little hole near the top of them and stuffed in some of the spicy confit leg meat, a few pieces of cheese curd, and then just laid a slice of the duck breast, a piece of the, like a shard of the duck skin bacon, and a little piece of onion on top.
Sweet.
And it was pretty cute.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
And yeah, it was pretty tasty. Not as spicy as a jalapeno popper, but a little bit of heat from the hot sauce and the leg meat and stuff.
Cool.
It was probably the most.
It sounds pretty like a pretty original creation. I don't know like how much of that is ripped from the traditional duck popper blog stuff that you were reading, but man, yeah, that sounds like nothing I've ever really had before.
I think it was the most work I've ever done for an hors d'oeuvre.
Really? Yeah.
I don't know. It was a lot. It
sounds like, yeah.
I think typically, the way that Hank Shaw describes it, the most classic version of the duck popper, dove popper, is jalapeno pepper filled with cream cheese and a slice of the bird you're using, I think wrapped in bacon and doused with Italian dressing. He said that's the like most common baseline.
Italian dressing.
Yeah. Zesty Italian.
Oh, you mean that traditional salad dressing from Italy?
Yeah. From the Kraft, okay. The Kraft region of Italy. Yeah, that's right.
From the Kraft region of Italy. Yeah, I know which dressing you're talking about. I've had that before. Man, it's delicious.
The duckskin bacon I would revisit. Well, except like it was a bit of a weird situation because usually, obviously, if you're confing legs and, you know, pan roasting breasts, like you want the skin on very much, but I thought it'd be weird.
Right, yeah.
Like if the skin is in the popper, like it's not going to be crisp and everything. So
it wouldn't be crispy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a way, there must be a way to like puff the skin that was on the breast to make it like chicharron kind of situation.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. There's one in, if I remember right, in Modernist Cuisine. What? Is that the name of the series? The books?
Yeah.
Okay, Modernist Cuisine.
Yep.
They've got a porchetta where they remove the skin before it's cooked, make it into chicharron, but then like pulse it in a food processor and then somehow adhere it back onto the porchetta. you could do something like that. Or just make duck skin chicharron. I don't see why that wouldn't work.
That must be a thing, right? Yeah. Like you must just be able to, puff it using oil or something like that. Mm-hmm. I've never had to do that. Never tried to do it. But I mean, you can certainly puff it when you're trying to crisp it up when it's still attached to the breast, mm-hmm. when you're trying to, you know, make a duck breast with crispy skin. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. cool. Okay. So that was the appetizer.
Yeah.
And then, the main course and dessert were like just single component, like
grilled cheese. Yeah.
There was no time left to do anything.
First course was a take on French onion soup. We're working with wild onion, Allium senescens. It's sometimes called German garlic or something. I don't know. It's got a terrible, I can't remember what the common name is. It's terrible. And the trick was like, so it's easy to make a really good broth, like the soupy part of French onion soup with the like wild onions and wild mushrooms, like all the flavors there. You don't really cook it in any novel way.
Right.
Although we did burn a lot of the onions and use that to flavor the broth.
Smart.
But the difficulty is more like in the bread and cheese gratin top, because we don't have an oven on site. We're just cooking with fire. And so the idea was, it was totally Kevin's idea. And when he said it, I was like, well, that maybe will work, or maybe it will be terrible. I have absolutely no idea. But when we started playing with it, it worked quite well. The idea was just to put a skillet over a fire, drop cheese in it, and then dunk bread, like, and then press the bread into that cheese and then lift it out.
Oh, like, so kind of like make a frico and then put it on.
Yeah. Top. Like a frico that's only crispy on one side. And then before you flip it, press the bread into it. And what was like, it makes sense. Like it worked very well, but we did strike upon this one technique that was really fun. I cut the bread into length, say like six to 8 inch lengths that are an inch and a half or 2 inches wide. Pre grill those over the fire so they're a little bit crunchy but still soft on the inside, and then make these long lines of cheese in the pan. Wait for it to melt and to start to like just being crispy on the outside, and then you can like press the bread into it and roll it all, so you end up with like this long stick that's like entirely encased in crispy cheese, but then has gooey cheese underneath and crispy bread beneath that and soft, moist bread on the inside. And then just like shove that into the soup. So it's like hanging out in a weirdly vulgar way. And it was really
so tasty. It's like a real amazing, but crazy looking breadstick instead of the gratin top.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool.
So that was fun.
Yeah. One of my, I don't know, like I've used this at several places, but one of my favorite ideas for making grilled cheese is to like, you make a grilled cheese sandwich basically, except like one of the sides, like you grill one of the sides of the bread normally, but then when you go to flip it, you put
more cheese
in the pan.
Yes.
And then which I love. There's like a name for it even. It's like a, I don't know, crown grilled cheese or something like that. I don't know. I think so.
Drift, I don't know if they still do, but there was certainly at least one summer where Drift did that, and they had the crispy cheese oriented vertically, like the sandwich is sitting flat, and that he called it the Drift sail or something like that, like this vertical
cheese frigo.
Yeah.
Cool. Right on. So you had the soup ready to go basically, and then you just made the breadsticks on site, kind of heated up the soup and made the breadsticks. Yeah,
exactly.
That's cool.
The soup in a pot, a little grill for the bread, and then a pan for this cheesy breadstick.
Yeah.
For the main course for this, it needed to be, this, like I said, was a field cookery course. And so the principal plate was to be a demonstration of how to braise in a Dutch oven over a fire. And Kevin's really in love with an old Jacques Pepin dish called, I think it's like poulet breast à la crème. Like it's chicken and cream sauce.
Cool. So you guys got a breast chicken then?
Well, we did rabbit à la crème.
That's even fancier than a breast chicken.
I'd say so, yeah. And this one was pretty, like, besides being outdoors over a fire in a Dutch oven, it was pretty pretty classic, I would say. We did some tweaks maybe, but it was like bone-in rabbit cut to pieces, dredged in flour, lightly browned in butter, taken out, and then we were using leek and onion and black garlic.
Oh man, I was so hoping you were gonna say pearl onion.
Oh, so that would be amazing. Yeah, I mean, that would have been the most French thing we could have done, probably. Yeah,
yeah, that would have been the most classic. Yeah,
a little bit of mustard, white wine. Rabbit went back in, and then just cover the whole thing with heavy cream and leave it over the fire to simmer for a couple hours.
Dang. I rarely braise things in cream. That's, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It tasted like, and one of the featured, we were trying to get the flavor of yarrow to come through. So actually we had yarrow blossoms in with the mirepoix. I don't know if it was present in the final dish, to be honest, but it is a really nice.
What does yarrow taste like? I don't even really, I guess, have a solid flavor memory for what that's like. Yeah,
well, don't get mad, Shale, but it's quite floral.
I believe you.
I can't think of what to compare it to. That was actually the first time that I had used it. Like, I have it in my yard, but I didn't even know that it could be used that way. But yeah, braising in, you know, 90% cream and 10% wine, it was delicious. It tastes, when I was eating it, we served it with rice, and maybe that was part of the reason that I felt like it tasted like curry without the curry, if that makes sense. Like a really rich, like creamy, buttery tikka masala kind of situation, but there's no curry spice. It's all like French mustard, wine, onion kind of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because that texturally, you know, like I guess probably, yeah, most of the creamy stews that I generally eat in my daily life, even though there are European ones, most of the ones that I eat, you know, in my regular everyday life are like, yeah, either Southeast Asian or Indian curries. Cool. And the rabbit, like you already said, that you can't actually serve game, right? So,
right, yeah. So
farm raised rabbits.
Yeah, farmed rabbit. It was purchased at the Italian Center. I don't remember the producer. I think like when we get rabbit at Nate, I believe it comes from Quebec. I'm not aware of an Alberta commercial rabbit producer, but
yeah. I'm rarely out looking for it, but yeah, nothing comes to mind.
It's a pretty, like, I think it's exotic for a lot of people, but it's a pretty approachable meat. Like it.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I hate to say it, but it tastes like chicken.
Tastes like chicken. I mean, sort of, yeah. It has a tendency to, I don't know, like it's a little harder to cook than chicken, I think. It can have a tendency to wind up being drier,
right?
Easier, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Stringy is a word that comes to mind, even though I don't like to use that word. But yeah, it can be. Like there's really long muscle fibers in the legs, and if you don't treat it right, you can, it can wind up, you know, not being great.
Right.
So it's a little trickier to cook with, I think.
Yeah, and you kind of have to. When I first tried cooking it years ago, I was like so worried about like, oh, but like I can't cook the loin with the legs, like, because do you know what I mean? Like thinking about pork and beef, it's like, oh, well, this is loin, so it must be a like super tender dry cut, and if I overcook, like if I braise it with the legs, it'll be dry. But it's not, doesn't really work the same way. Like it's a small animal, and it's like a twitchy, hoppy, erratic animal, and so all of the like the muscles have the different muscle groups, even though they do have different colors a bit, like they do behave pretty similarly. Like the difference between rabbit saddle, like which has the loin, and rabbit leg is not half as dramatic as it would be
the difference between chicken tenders and chicken thighs,
or pork or duck
or stuff on a bigger animal.
I do like it though.
Cool.
And then dessert was a fun one for this. It was to be a custard flavored with dandelion coffee and gallium. So the...
Gallium?
Yeah. Okay, so...
Like the metal?
Was that a metal? Oh, is that... it's an element or something? So there's a family of plants that is very common where we live, like in the River Valley and out in parkland, called bedstraw.
Okay.
And the one that I was very familiar with, one type of it, it's called northern bedstraw. And I just knew it because it like has really pretty little white flowers in the early summer and kind of a distinct, the stem has a square cross section and the leaves grow in really distinct, like quadrant, like two opposing, like two going north, south and two going west, east. These groups of four, all the way up the stem. It was just something that I identified years ago. And then once you know what it looks like, you see it everywhere. Where we live, there's a closely related one. I'm sorry. So that's the genus is Gallium boreale, but we call it northern bedstraw. And there's a closely related plant that I didn't know about until last week, called fragrant bedstraw, Gallium triflorum. Mm. And Kevin,
let me guess, floral.
It's well, okay. This one I can be a bit more specific with. I won't just evade the question by saying it's floral. And here's another crazy thing: picked fresh, it is not very aromatic, despite its name. It's not very aromatic when it's freshly picked. But if you leave it to dry, even for a few hours, it has an intense, intense aroma of like something like tonka bean, something like vanilla.
Oh.
And
cool.
I was shocked, actually. Like the power of the aroma is pretty stunning. Like we had a little bag of it. I ended up using all of it, and I know that it was 3 grams, and it was like powerfully redolent with this really distinct tonka bean smell.
That's interesting.
And
do you know if it's like, can you grow it, or does it have like,
oh, that's a good question. I don't know if it's like, I don't know if you could take a wild specimen and propagate it. I do know that it is, so I don't know if it's related or if it just has a similar aroma to something called woodruff be grown.
Yeah. Woodruff. Yeah. Woodruff is, yeah. And woodruff is also, I would say, yeah, very
tonka-ish something. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think the origin of the idea for the dish is that Kevin's really interested in finding flavors and aromas that grow wild in our part of the world that can kind of like be plugged into our cuisine to replace some of the more exotic imported ingredients. And so,
right, like imagine it's a zombie apocalypse,
right?
And you get all of you're traveling with a group of people, and you all get to safety, and everyone's like feeling a moment of levity. And then suddenly someone's like, oh man, you know what I really miss? Vanilla ice cream.
Right. Yeah.
And then you're like, oh yeah, well, unfortunately we can't have vanilla anymore because I don't know, all the vanilla got, I don't know, like hoarded by people or something. And there's no vanilla around, and so how are you going to provide your people with this moment of satisfaction, mm-hmm. Of like giving them the you know, like making their vanilla dream come true? Mm-hmm. You have to substitute something, and so you know, you look around and what do you have? Well, woodruff,
right?
Or people really want coffee, and I don't know, some people like ransacked the stores and drank it all, and
right.
So you need to dig up some dandelions and dry them out.
Yeah.
And
I have a lot to respond to in that little sarcastic tirade. One is that Funny enough, 1 year when I was an organizer for a conference called Eat Alberta, the theme was, which was a conference that brought in local experts to teach people how to source and cook local food. One of the annual themes was surviving the zombie apocalypse. Okay. And at the end of the conference, I led a discussion with a panel of experts on how, like the conceit was, yes, okay, it's the zombie apocalypse. So like, how do we support, or how do we feed ourselves with local ingredients now that right, it's the end of the world? And Kevin was on that panel.
Oh, cool.
So, and the other thing I wanted to pick up on was that the reason that vanilla would cease to exist after a zombie apocalypse is that, did you know, Shale, the vanilla plant needs to be pollinated by hand by humans?
By hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, not necessarily by humans, but it does need to be like something needs to pollinate it. It doesn't happen of its own accord or naturally.
Yeah, like not naturally. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was like, regardless of whether, I don't know, maybe if you had a really crazy greenhouse, you could grow vanilla here. I don't know.
Probably not.
I doubt it. Yeah. I was just thinking like the only vanilla we would have access to is whatever was on store shelves before the world ended.
Right. And that all the shelves would be empty. Yeah.
That's just not around here.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. Sad for poor vanilla.
Yep.
I mean, I guess corn's like that too. So.
How so?
Isn't there something like without, like, there's no natural way for corn to reproduce? Don't humans have to? Isn't like human intervention required to reproduce like corn in its current state, like not wild corn and stuff like that? But
I have no idea. Although I vaguely remember something about, I think there's a whole section of, or a chapter of Omnivore's Dilemma that's like called something vulgar, like how corn has sex or how corn reproduces or something like that.
Okay.
And maybe it addresses that. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, I forget where I heard that. I think I heard it like in a movie or something, but I think I like looked it up after, and yeah, it requires human propagation as far as I'm aware.
Okay, I'll get back to you. Follow
up for the next episode, the corn special.
Yeah. Anyway, so we were going to make a custard with dandelion coffee and gallium, and it was the first time I've had either of those. Have you had dandelion coffee before?
No, actually, maybe I might have tried it once. Yeah, but it was a long time ago, and I don't really remember if it tasted like anything.
If you like, calling it coffee is definitely a misnomer, and I wouldn't. I think that if you go in expecting it to be a coffee substitute, you will be disappointed. Even if it were called dandelion root tea or something, that would be a better way to manage expectations.
Right.
It smells actually quite chocolatey. Like it smells more like cocoa powder than it does like coffee. Like the ground stuff in the bag.
That's interesting.
And then steeped in water, it's bitter. It definitely does not have any of the like, well, it's caffeine free. It's doesn't have any of the acidity of coffee. Like it hasn't gone through a fermentation the way that coffee has.
Right.
So yeah, bitter.
Because of lack of effort.
Yeah. Lazy dandelions. And yeah, it's bitter. It's subtly tannic, like black tea. Yeah. But in the custard, yeah. With the fat of the egg yolk and sweetness of the sugar, it actually, that bitterness was quite nice. Like as the bitterness of dark chocolate would be.
That's cool.
And
a lot of cream in this menu, Alan.
It's funny you should mention that was actually a topic of discussion in the planning of the menu. And believe it or not, we took some dairy elements out a little bit, but you're right. There's,
oh really?
Yeah. The principal components of the main plate and the dessert were cream. You're right. And there was cheese in the two courses before that. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. But, it was good.
And it was moose milk that you used, right?
Exactly. And bear milk, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, in the custard, the bitterness was pretty nice. Mm. Would you say, like, what, aside from the bitterness, like, you said there's, like, a chocolate aroma, mm-hmm. but what's the actual flavor of the dandelion? If you take the bitter, like, if you sort of set the bitterness aside, what's the flavor it's, like? And
maybe I need more exposure to it, but I found it a bit lacking, like, especially right. going in thinking about coffee, like, it's hard to pick up on what the inherent flavor is without the, without just that bitterness. But I will say, there was a few dandelion root products, that Kevin, had brought to use. And one of them was just dandelion root dried and ground. So not, not roasted.
Right. Okay.
And just eating that out of hand, it tasted nutty. It tasted like, the texture was not the same, but it tasted just like sunflower seeds to me. Sunflower seeds, maybe pumpkin seeds.
I'm not surprised, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. When you started saying it, I was like, when you said nutty, I was like, oh, he's going to say sunflower seeds. Because, because sunflower seeds out of all of the, like, nut seed things sort of have kind of, man, I don't want to say it, but they taste earthy.
Really?
Dang. Okay. I mean, they do have like a subtle bitterness and they have a little bit of nuttiness, but they also have kind of this complex kind of minerally flavor or something. And it's a very root like flavor, okay. I feel like. And so, yeah, when you started talking about it, I was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I need to taste it more, I guess. I don't think there was anything in the, like, the actual brewed dandelion coffee that I would have described as nutty or sunflower seed. Like, it really was like, a vaguely cocoa-like bitterness minus the acidity. And on the palate, like an oversteeped black tea astringency.
Right. Okay. Oh yeah. So yeah. Tannins, mm-hmm. tannins and bitterness without any of the flavor. Sounds amazing.
Yeah. Sorry. in the custard, it actually was quite nice.
That's cool.
I don't think I fully succeed. Perhaps it's like a delicate flavor, like the bedstraw couldn't stand up to the bitterness of the dandelion, but I don't think that I succeeded in really having the bedstraw, the gallium flavor shine.
Like come through.
Yeah.
Oh, so you used both of those things to flavor the custard.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. And was there another component to the dessert or?
It was just the custard and it was bruleed and there was some toasted hazelnuts on top of it.
I see. And did you bring the custard already set?
Yes.
Or did
Neat and just brought it in. Yeah.
Gotcha. Because I don't know, cooking custard in the wild, that'd be an interesting thing to try and figure
out. That's true. Although that was kind of like, I think one of the big talking points of the day for field cookery was like, make your life in the field easy by doing as much prep as you can.
At home.
Yeah. So it's like, why, like, you know, cut your mirepoix and put it in a deli cup and put it in your backpack. Like, don't bring an onion and leek and a head of garlic and a knife and have to...
And try and cut it with a butter knife that you got from your, like, field kit
from your
or
Swiss
whatever.
Army knife, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. And so the custard kind of plays to that, because whether it's a set custard or a stirred custard or just, like, something like yogurt, like, something that's kind of neutral, but, like, you can add lots of flavor to if you have jam or nuts or whatever. Yeah, just pack it in and...
You know, it'd be really the like best case scenario for a custard to cook in the wild would be posset.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, that'd be pretty easy to pull off.
I wonder if that.
If you had to cook a set custard over a campfire, Alan, how would you do it?
Water bath. Yeah. Water bath and tinfoil.
Water bath and steam. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
Water bath in a Dutch oven over a fire.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then fire management. I think that, I think that would work.
To keep it from getting too hot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd totally work.
Mm-hmm. Kate, next time.
Next time. Actually, next time you should do like a giant, like one of those huge, like creme caramels that's in like a big pot, like in really? A big Dutch oven like that.
I haven't seen that, like a communal creme caramel.
Yeah, you've never seen that? I think, I'm not 100% sure, but like, I think that's sort of like the original incarnation of creme caramel. And I think it's like a fairly, this is like just straight like memory of someone that I knew from Quebec, but telling me that, you know, it's often like in home settings, like it's often served like a big dish. So like really? You cook it in a big Dutch oven and like turn it out, or like in a big rondeau and turn it out onto a plate. And then there's this just like big pool of caramel that comes, and then you cut slices of it and serve it that way. Yeah.
It sounds like the way.
Yeah. And I was shocked when I first heard that too. I was like, what, how, and why? And that seems very complicated, and it seems like it could be extremely prone to failure, mm-hmm. but man, it's fascinating to me now. I'm like, man, that sounds like a fun challenge to get something like that perfect.
Yeah, I would wonder, like a creme caramel with the texture that I associate with it from modern restaurants seems like much mm-hmm. too delicate to be
delicate.
That big and turned out. But if you made it more like a flan, like a Mexican flan or something, that was
I think
out.
Maybe yeah. a slightly more set texture mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. But yeah. Maybe you wouldn't do it quite as delicate as you can get away with in a ramekin, but.
And the real difficulty, we might have had this exact conversation last year, I can't remember. But like if you're making creme brulee in the wild over a fire and you don't have a blowtorch, the more difficult problem to solve would be, how do you brulee it?
Branding iron.
Yeah. I think, yeah, some kind of iron. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But you need to just put a think ahead and bring your brulee iron.
Yeah. Some kind of iron. Yeah. Yeah. But that's real. And they really do brulee creme brulees that way in some restaurants. Mm-hmm. Like they just heat up like a hot iron and just like press it onto the surface. Mm-hmm. Or they like cheat and torch it. And then they have like a little logo iron that they press right. into it to like, actually a lot of Japanese cheesecakes like employ like a sort of branding iron to put the like company's brand on the top of the cheesecake, or like a lot of like there are several baked goods that they sort of do that treatment.
Yes,
they like brand the top of them.
Pablo definitely does that here. Yeah.
Yeah, Pablo does that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. I guess I didn't get to come out again this year, but it's too busy for me.
Yeah, it's a funny time of year, but
such is life. Mm. I have to do my own wild cooking experiences. But yeah, I'll let you know if I find any mushrooms in Mill Creek in the next week or so.
Kate, yeah.
Definitely going to keep my eyes peeled. It said it was going to rain today, but it didn't really. But I think it may still be set to rain tomorrow. So,
oh, is that right?
You know, usually the day after it rains, right? That's when you get like a lot of fruiting bodies.
Oh, I think I think it's a lot more mysterious than that. Maybe that's true for some.
Oh, okay.
For some
mushrooms, yeah.
But yeah, whether it rains or not, I think it's a good time to go out and look for fruiting bodies.
Cool. I'll have to leave some messages on the Alberta Mycological Society's TikTok and try and get some pointers.
Does the AMS have a TikTok?
Yeah, that's how they really do.
Really? Oh, cool.
Yep. Yeah, it's been showing up on my For You page. I wasn't as verbose about that at the beginning of the show as I meant to be, but yeah, I've been seeing a bunch of their posts on TikTok, and that's how I found out that it was like a big year for mushrooms. So,
sorry, you did say that. I just, for some reason, the TikTok the TikTok piece evaded me.
Slipped right off your mind. Yeah.
Because I don't know what TikTok is. So.
That's right. We're going to have to do another TikTok episode just so that I can get you to download it.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.